Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And, you know, being an Illinois Republican is sort of like being a graduate of Northwestern University, Amy. And what is it I say about Northwestern every time it's in the news? Amy, do we have Amy? Is Amy here? Or is she still mourning the loss of Dinkle's Bakery in Lakeview? Okay. Well, I'll answer my own question then. Every time Northwestern is in the news, you're embarrassed to be a Northwestern grad. That's sort of my axiom I've come up with to describe my alma mater. And so every
time, we were having headset problems, but yes, your value of your degree has gone down.
Yeah.
I heard something about Northwestern. I saw purple, and then I said that.
Yeah, okay. Well, so being a Northwestern grad is sort of like being a Illinois Republican. Every time an Illinois Republican is in the news, you're further embarrassed if you identify as an Illinois Republican. You see the parallel. And so two Illinois Republicans are in the news, and they've become one.
Oh, and they're the same person. You're right. Yep.
That's not something anybody could have foreseen, would have thought a decade ago. Certainly I wouldn't have. I'm talking about outgoing Congressman Adam Kinzinger and former lottery ticket puncher, one-term Republican Joe Walsh.
Yeah, we used to have a show here for years.
Yeah, how embarrassing for Salem Media and AM 560 that he did.
What he did was despicable.
Joe Walsh tweeted out, you know, on the topic of Russia and Ukraine and the neocons and the charlatans and the dilettantes of all stripes like to use Tucker Carlson as their whipping boy because of his popularity. And I don't agree with Tucker Carlson a lot of the times. We've had discussions on the very topic, including his, at least some of his initial opinions about Russia, Ukraine, and what the U.S. posture should be towards the Russian invasion. Didn't agree. But, of course, they have to go where the left goes, which is, if you don't agree with me, then you're a Putin apologist. You're probably a Russian asset.
He's a Russian spy, really.
So Joe Walsh tweeted out on the, you know, against the backdrop of the images we've all seen over the last several days of the Russians' massacre of Ukrainians in Bucha.
Yeah, people hog-tied and shot in the head and their bodies left in the streets. It's just awful.
Walsh's tweet, Tucker Carlson tonight, quote, quotation mark, that's important. What if these bodies of tortured dead civilians were staged? What if they're fake? What if the Ukrainian military killed them and then blamed Russia? I'm not saying any of this is true. I'm just asking the questions. Why can't we ask these questions? Unquote. So he presented this fictional quotation as something Tucker Carlson actually said, which he didn't say.
Yeah, he tweeted out a fake quote from him, and it was a manufactured lie.
And Adam Kinzinger responded to the Joe Walsh tweet, retweeting it, saying, I got to say, if Tucker Carlson is not a Russian asset, he should be. He is absolutely overqualified for the job. Is he a Russian asset? I don't know. Just asking questions. So you have Joe Walsh, who's a charlatan, and for those people who were duped by him, it's okay. It's okay. Whether he was as a candidate or the brief member of Congress, member of Congress for a brief time, or for his few years on AM 560, I understand sometimes people recite a script and you believe it's authentic. Never was. should have axed somebody who knew him for a couple of decades, like myself. But
yeah, you're never on the Team Walsh.
That's okay.
Well,
that's
you knew something. You were clairvoyant. I don't know what you knew that we didn't know.
Well, yeah, you have history, and you see people behave, and you understand who they actually are versus who they're presenting themselves to the public to be. We have that going on again in the Illinois Republican Party. His name is Richard Ervin. He's the mayor of Aurora. He's mm-hmm. a candidate for governor. And it's the same scam that's being run by the same scam artist. You know, one of the ways to tell in Illinois if the candidate you're assessing is a scam artist?
It won't come on a Republican radio show?
That's one way. The leading indicator is mm-hmm. that candidate has the endorsement of most of the Republican establishment. The more elected Republican office holders who endorse a candidate, the less you should trust them. In Illinois.
I know. And there's a list of 61 of them, folks. And there's so Republicans that everybody knows that's on that list supporting
when
Richard
all
Ervin.
Of the Vichy Republicans of always in Illinois are unified behind a candidate, that's when your spidey sense should be tingling. And so that was the case with Adam Kinzinger, and I made a mistake. Back when Adam Kinzinger first ran, when he and Don Manzullo were drawn together in a congressional district, and I sided with Kinzinger in that race because Manzullo had been there for a long time, good conservative voting record, but I didn't see him as a party leader, party builder. He sort of became a creature of Washington. And I thought Kinzinger had the disposition and the chops to help build the party locally while also doing his work in D.C., and I was wrong. You know, how naive was I? So, you know, I made a mistake. So I get it. I get it with Walsh. But let's not keep making the same mistakes. How about that? Well, so now you have Adam Kinzinger, who was first embarrassingly duped by a comedian online with this ghost of Kiev fighter pilot that was shooting down Russian jets, Russian fighters that doesn't exist. It was completely made up. It was just a send-up, and Kinzinger fell for it. Now he's falling for and falling in line with one of Borat's go-to dupes, Joe Walsh.
Right.
Joe Walsh, not Borat the movie, but Borat when he had that series called Who's America? And he did a piece called Kinder Guardians that was focused on arming children starting in kindergarten so they can defend themselves in the event of a school shooting. And here was Joe Walsh being interviewed by, you know, Borat or one of the characters Sacha Baron Cohen plays for these bits that he does. Joe Walsh on what you can do to turn your toddler into a first grenader.
The intensive 3-week kindergarten course introduces specially selected children from 12 to 4 years old to pistols, rifles, semi-automatics, and a rudimentary knowledge of mortars.
Yeah, remember it was Happy Shooting Kids.
Happy Shooting Kids.
Yeah, and I asked him about this. I was like, come on, you knew that was Sacha Baron Cohen. I had no idea, Amy. And then I asked his wife, like, are you sure? And she said, we had no idea.
That makes it worse.
I know, Dan.
Because he wasn't playing along. He just recited those words. And he literally says, in 3 months, you can turn your kindergartner into a first grenader.
I know. Happy shooting.
So this is somebody who will do and say anything to be on TV to raise his profile. That's Joe Walsh. He's a charlatan.
Yeah, what peed me off.
And so that's now Adam Kinzinger. And that's what we've seen from Adam Kinzinger over the last year since he voted for year plus now since he voted for Trump's impeachment and decided to cast his fate with CNN and the Beltway media. They're the same person. Kinzinger, a favorite of the Republican establishment, so the Republican part of the combine in Illinois, and Walsh, who was a favorite for a time of the Tea Party. And that's Illinois. And you wonder why it's the worst governed state in American history. You wonder where the electoral competition is.
And after Joe Walsh got caught in the lie, he tweeted out, I tweeted this out this morning. I was predicting what Tucker Carlson would say tonight. Here's what's funny. So many people read this tweet and believed Tucker had already said it.
It's not funny. It's not an indication of how people are in the tank for this conspiracy theory. There's nothing funny about it. It's pathetic.
Well, it didn't stop users online from talking about it.
It's pathetic that a sitting congressman with a military background would retweet somebody like Joe Walsh, who he knows from Illinois politics. And he knows what a buffoon that Walsh is. Of course, everybody does. And those who didn't, a few years ago, certainly do now.
I love Glenn Greenwald. He said Adam Kinzinger took a fabricated quote from a longtime deadbeat dad turned liberal hero and believed it to be true.
So are we going to fall for this again in Illinois? 312-642-5600, turnkey dot pro answer line. Are we going to fall for this again in the governor's race? Since Walsh and Kinzinger are now irrelevant. They're relevant only as cautionary tales, and they've become one person. And that's just such an interesting development to me, because it was different factions within the GOP ranks that tried to sell these two candidates. And I say, I take responsibility for my initial support of Kinzinger. I was clearly wrong about that in retrospect. I should have known better than to believe anybody anybody running for office in the state is actually interested in party building. I don't know where my head was. I should have known better. The triumph of hope over experience at that point. But we have the same thing going on now. Somebody who will say and do anything to get office, and then will say and do anything to take their next step in career advancement, whether it's in politics or in media. Same thing is going on right now, backed by a billionaire.
64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Schock and Kinzinger started out like Romeo and Juliet, but they ended in tragedy. That's from Steve on 88.
That's a good one, too. Yeah. There's another one, Schock, another golden boy.
Yeah. Whatever happened to him?
I'm saying, every Same time thing. An Illinois Republican is in the news, if you're an Illinois Republican, you're further shamed.
You die a little inside, yes.
Jim in Crown Point.
Joe Walsh is an over-enunciating jackass. It's amazing. These guys that will say anything are the ones that believe anything. You've got Adam Schiff talking, got sucked in by the guy that poses a Russian disc jockey that had evidence about Trump. All these guys, that's what they do. Joe Walsh is just, that's his demo tape for MSNBC every time he opens his mouth.
Well, I know.
Well, he needs to make money, guys, and so does Adam Kinzinger.
Yeah, no.
Knew the writing was on the wall, so he's like, well, I'm just going to join whatever I can. I'm going to sell my soul to the devil to work for a publication or a news organization to make money and feed my family.
Well, Walsh's presidential run, he had hoped that he'd be on the MSNBC desk already. So he's got to continue to, run his racket and see if he can enlist some unwitting dupes. I mean, he's doing to Kinzinger what Borat did to Walsh. Paying it forward. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you, Dan, for taking my call. Boy, you are right on the money with Joe Walsh and Kinzinger, and I'm glad you warned us about Irwin, because that Darren Bailey, I think he's the good guy in ring. But anyways, hey, listen, they got some kind of problem. This Kinzinger, Joe Walsh, they had good careers going. They could have been really good top guys in with the Republicans. I mean, they shot them. They destroyed their own careers. And a part of it was that Trump syndrome, where they just hate that guy. They're like a little punk kid in school. And then they turned out to be little rat traitors against Trump in that. Not against the Republican. I think it was all based on Trump, that they basically turned into like idiots and everything, doing all kinds of stupid stuff and everything, but didn't know enough that they can support their own career or do good things for their own career. Just get in there and be little snakes and do all kinds of bad things and everything.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Appreciate it. And what are we treated? What are we treated with from both of these guys all the time? Every time you hear from them, they tell you how much of a patriot they are.
Oh, that's right.
I'm a patriot, I'm a patriot, I'm a patriot. It is incessant, incessant. And if you disagree with me, you're not a patriot.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word APP to 64636 to download the app today.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. On Monday, a assistant corp counsel for the city of New York and mom of three named Daniela Jampel crashed Mayor Eric Adams' press conference to challenge him about the mask mandate on toddlers aged 2 to 4 in New York City.
So stupid.
She reminded him that as a candidate, he had promised to rescind that order. Here's Ms. Jampel's description of her view on the policy and the mayor.
So my name is Daniela, and this morning I walked into the mayor's press conference at 11 a.m. as a private citizen to ask him why he decided to renege on his promise to unmask our toddlers. 3 weeks ago, some parents confronted him at a bar on St. Patrick's Day, and he said, trust me, they'll be unmasked. And then 10 days ago, he announced that on April 4th, they would be unmasked. And then on Friday, at the 11th hour, he told us, actually, no, they will not be. So I am a private citizen. He is my mayor. He works for us. And I think I deserve to hold him accountable. You know, it's really hard. I had very high hopes for this mayor. I thought he'd be a moderate. I thought he'd govern accordingly. And for him to keep children aged 2 to 4 masks, and I really want to point out here that nowhere else is this happening. Very few places is this happening. It's not happening in Westchester. It's not happening on Long Island. And if he thinks that the science means that these children have to be masked, then by all means, he should share that with other places because they deserve to know too. But there is no science that requires our children aged 2 to 4 to mask. He knows that. That's why he's not talking about it. I don't know why they're doing this, but it's really unfair to our toddlers.
And then yesterday she was fired from her job as assistant corp counsel while on maternity leave.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I have a number of problems with this story. First of all, they were in a public place. Okay, that was open to the public when they said that it was a stunt that she posed as a journalist. Well, she's written op-eds before. And so technically, in my opinion, she is a journalist, the written word. So they had that was a problem that they had with, and she's just fighting for her children. And now you fight for your children and you're going to lose your livelihood because you care about your kids. They said that, but real quick, they said too, that she did not lose her job because of what she said, because of the stunt that they pulled. They said they had problems with her tweet because after the ruling, you know, after Friday's appeal, she took to Twitter and tweeted, you know, I've represented cops who lie in court, teachers who molest children, prison guards who beat inmates. It is a job I've done proudly until tonight. Fighting to keep masks on toddlers is shameful, and I'm ashamed of my office. And they said that's the reason why they fired her.
Well, I mean, hey, if you want to put yourself on the line, you can put your job on the line, too. I mean, she knew the risks. I know she said she's retaining counsel. She's not going to litigate this in public, but she's an attorney. She could have anticipated what the response would be from the mayor and from the corp counsel's office. She's an at-will employee.
Well, so. I don't care. I am sick of these tyrants. And Eric Adams, he's a disgrace. He is exactly the opposite of what we parents thought that he would be. He lied. I mean, I saw that video, too, that she's talking about. And I've been talking to her via DM from Twitter, trying to get her on the show. But, you know, she is going to be obtaining counsel, but he told them to their face that, yeah, this will end. There's no reason, there's no science or data in the world to show why it is effective to mask kids 2 to 4 years old. In fact, kids that are 2 to 4, they chew on their masks all day long. And some of them, they're dripping with drool. And I just know that because my sister teaches 3 to 4 year olds and they used to have to be masked and they're not masked anymore. And that's in the state of Missouri. But then this is the only place where they're still masked.
Well, New York Times splashy headline in the last couple of days talking about Omicron part two and the potential of a rise in cases. And you have Tony Fauci. He was on CBS, the CBS affiliate in New York over the weekend, and he said this.
New York, we are starting to see a slight uptick in cases. I wonder if you think businesses and schools need to be prepared to shut down again.
Oh, you know, God. I don't want to use the word shut down because that is a rather draconian concept there to shut down. If we do see a serious uptick, we should be prepared to pivot and at least temporarily go back to having masking in certain indoor sessions.
Oh, my God. See, masks don't work. Vaccinations don't work.
Eric Adams is just, out of an abundance of caution.
Oh, stop.
He is taking Tony Fauci's advice. He's trying to be proactive, which any good leader would do, and protect the children, save lives, protect the children. And he's starting with the toddlers 2 to 4 because they're not eligible for the vaccine. So another COVIDian hero who I'm sure will be regaled as such by the New York Times for his courageous leadership in this difficult time of pandemic. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text. And I know what you're thinking.
What?
In addition to this heroism exhibited by Mayor Adams, you're thinking, as we've heard from callers during the whole last 2 years of masking, what's the harm? Why not err on the side of caution? What is the big deal?
Because
with
children
kids
need to see
wearing masks.
Kids need to see other people's faces. It's this thing called phonics that people seem to have forgotten, and they're scared of germs. We're creating these people. They're mentally ill. This is an illness with these masks on, and everyone is wearing them, and still on at school, and I see them all the time. It's just mind blowing.
Yeah, they're doing that, but what's the harm?
Well, here's the thing, because they don't need to wear masks. And Dr. Ezeki, on her last day in office, finally came clean and told the truth, which I know she knew this from the beginning.
We know that our younger people have fared well with this disease compared to some other disease. They've done better with this than they have with the flu or RSV.
Well, thanks. It's about time you told the truth.
Yeah, because of the masks. And because of vaccines and because of the mitigations, because of 6 feet away, because of people standing on their idiot circles, because we're all in the same boat together, because we locked down for 2 weeks to slow the spread, because we protected our hospitals. Yeah, I mean, because we listened to Dr. Ezeki and Dr. Awadi and Pritzker and de Blasio and Whitmer and Newsom and Hogan and Baker and Murphy and Fauci and all of the COVIDians who led us out of the desert and to the promised land. And we need to continue to defer to their expertise in order to save lives.
There's a school in Missouri, and I'm trying to get the name of the school. It's an elementary school where they have a outbreak of the flu. You know, remember the flu when we used to talk about the flu? And they're suggesting, and they want people to put masks on.
Wear masks. Absolutely.
For the flu. No, we're not
masks
doing this.
Saved lives.
You're trying to make me go crazy.
Save lives during COVID. Uh-huh. Why, since flu, airborne, why wouldn't it also save lives with respect to influenza? And now we'll be reminded, what we were reminding people, that the flu is much more dangerous to children than COVID. So even more to the point, get the masks back on. Put the circles back down, the 6 feet apart, the remote learning. Let's beat the flu.
Well, let's stop
zero
testing.
Flu, I say.
Like right now, this morning, 719 perfectly healthy children in Chicago can't go to school. And they tested 66,000 people yesterday at CBS.
Yeah.
Stop with the testing.
Well, they could never go to school again if they die.
Oh, damn.
Did you ever think about that?
Well, our unmasked neighboring states fared better than us. And they're not testing. They're not quarantining. No, in fact, nobody in the state of Illinois is quarantining students if they've had an exposure to COVID except for CPS. And they're not going to stop. You think this is going to end next year? We're going to have to go through this same crap again next year, and I can't take it.
We need to do what we do all the time, every day, and that day is today. Ugh. Or something like that, as I understand from the vice president. So that means, yes, you're right. Saving lives, Ms. Jacobson, doesn't take a day off. And neither do our COVIDians.
You know what we were told yesterday? Because someone on the team had an exposure. that we're supposed to wear masks for the next 10 days.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, out of an abundance of caution.
We're all vaccinated and boosted. And I'm like, I can't. I'm just going to keep on.
What's
keeping
the harm?
On.
What's the harm?
Because you can't hear, because that's why we lose in volleyball. You have to communicate and talk to people. And this game, there are your setters that you can't hear a card laser going. Because they have a mask on their face. So we don't know what they're doing. And it's very frustrating. And it is detrimental to sports.
You can.
But the wrestlers don't have to wear a mask. But then you go in this gym and you have to wear a mask. So nothing is making sense anymore.
You can never win another volleyball game if you die. Ron and Carol Stream.
Mm-hmm. Hey, how you really feel. Hey, guys, thank you for taking my call. And your roast a couple weeks ago was fantastic. I love you guys. Now,
thank
Dan,
you
said, and I'm not calling to correct you, you said that she was fired yesterday. If I'm not mistaken, she was fired Monday, but then they came out Monday. And then they claimed, no, that happened Friday. These people are clowns. You know, I can't even believe what I'm seeing anymore. It's ridiculous, but thanks again for taking my call.
This mother of three is just sticking up for her children and the children in New York City, and she got fired for it.
Well,
think about that. Let that sink in.
She was fired on, I don't know if she got notice on Monday or Tuesday, they said she was fired on Friday after that tweet about this mask policy that Amy read. That's the position of the city. But regardless, she's being fired for advocacy against the policy that Adams is pursuing, whether it was because of the tweet or because of her question at the press conference. It's all of the same kind.
Yeah, but everyone has a right to free speech unless, you know, you're asking a question that they don't agree with.
You don't have a right to free speech in an employment situation.
All
it's
right.
The First Amendment is not a restraint on private actors, as you know. So the city is within its rights to fire her, I believe. But that's the legal aspect of it is separate and distinct from the moral question about whether you should have elected officials, you should be lorded over by administrations that take this posture with dissent. There's a cultural, there's a normative question, and then there's a legal question, and they're two separate questions. Tony, Downers Grove.
Well, hey, Dan, that's She could be fired, but like you said, that doesn't make it right that you can't speak your mind, and that's part of the problem.
I agree,
and it's part of the but it's part of the problem when you ask, are we going to be duped again in Illinois? Of course we are, because someone like Urban gets up and he has commercials. He can lie. I don't see anybody out there challenging what he's saying. That's no different than the national stage. And then if you take a certain position on any social media, you might get drowned out. So how do we overcome this and get over the hill? What is the answer if the politicians or the people who are running cannot stand up and take the fight to those who are fabricating things and bringing things on? Where do you go with this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question you raised, Tony. I mean, just on the Irvin matter and the lies that you're hearing from him, including his paid advertisements on this station, those will be challenged. June 28th is still a ways away. I can guarantee you the things he's saying and the how he's presenting himself
right.
In terms of who he is, that will be challenged before all is said and done.
I hope so.
Lou in Arlington Heights.
Audrey.
Hey, Lou. Lou.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey, I was just saying that, I say this jokingly, of course, but why stop at the flu? Why not keep the mask on until we cure the common cold?
Totally agree.
Masks are causing colds and
thanks
bacterial pneumonia. I mean, people get sick from wearing masks, too, because they're dirty and they wear them again and don't wash them, and it's stupid.
Well, I mean, we'll have to start punishing maybe another bureaucracy so that we have proper mask wearing going on in the schools. Maybe we need specific school staff
mm-hmm.
to make sure that kids are washing their masks, or maybe midway through the day there's a mask change out. Maybe we should have a mask grant program of some sort. I mean, there's always more programs and more people right. that we can hire to exact the central planning that's required to save lives.
Well, let's form a committee, Dan.
Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, that's the first time I ever heard Fauci use the word draconian. I was kind of surprised to hear him say that because he's never mentioned that before, and now he's not ready to go back to those measures. But yay. I wanted to say if the government spent more time talking to people about, you know, cancer prevention, diabetes prevention, obesity, all these other things that are killing heart health, killing millions of people. What do they have to say about that? Why, you know, this, they have gone so far overboard. Masks are still stupid. I still refuse. I will not wear a mask anywhere. I don't have them anymore. I take pleasure throwing them in the garbage. I'm done, Amy. I'm done.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. In terms of the question, you know, the response you get from these COVIDians, what's the harm? Err on the side of and all that. There's a good piece by Susie Weiss over at Barry Weiss's Substack. I'll tweet out. I'll tweet it, but don't have time to get into it too deeply. But the title of the piece is Teenage Girls Will Never Forget.
Oh.
And she interviews, Ms. Weiss, teenage girls and their moms, too, including one mom who's a pediatrician, talking about what this isolation both real lockdowns and the isolation that comes from feeling like you're not interacting on a human level with other kids, what it means. She writes, teenagers need a social life. Every single study and report and piece of data tells us so, but we don't need studies to tell us what we already know. Ask yourself, what would it have been like if you had spent your 13th year in solitude? It was more than a year, actually. Millions of American kids had gone a year and a half mostly alone, and every single girl I spoke with said the same thing about the experience. They felt like they were sinking or being swallowed up.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot about this over the course of the last 2 years plus, but you know, the storytelling is important, and listening to what some of these teenage girls and their moms have to say is very useful. And all you have to do is back that down to toddlers when you're talking about children in those formative years of intellectual, social, emotional development. And it's so ironic, too, because of the left's focus on social emotional learning, which, of course, is not real social and emotional development. It's just the entree to their Marxist curriculum. But they use those words and then they pursue policies that inhibit that sort of growth that we're actually talking about.
And this is not over. 719 kids are isolated in their homes today. And the same thing, they can't do schoolwork. They can if they take some homework home, but this is still going on. This is not over yet. And we cannot stop fighting until we can get that test to stay program and then eventually stop testing in schools and get back on to how life was before 2019.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. In the Northwest Suburban Corridor, the GOA Regional Business Association brings business leaders together to impact our community. Meet up at the GOA's Business Expo the afternoon of Thursday, April 29th in Schaumburg at Wintrust Field. It's free to attend and an opportunity to connect with business leaders in your community. Find all the details at thegoa.com. That's thegoa.com.
I used to do some work for the Greater O'Hare Association.
When you were working for Rosemont?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
In your triangle of what, Chicago mob town.
That's right. Yeah, my storied career, which was laid bare at my roast, which I guess you can watch online now, too.
Yeah, go to 560theanswer.com/roast. And there is a charge of $9.99, and my sister had to buy it.
It's well worth it. I mean, if you want to see me take a proper beating, then $10 isn't a big deal. It's well worth it because I do get a proper beating.
You do.
There.
Yeah. And then your stories were hysterical, too. And your roasts were okay. I mean, you're not funny like women are when it comes to jokes. But
right.
You try.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. We distributed at the roast the pamphlet of great female comedians.
Exactly.
Yeah. We added you to that flyer. All right. Yesterday, nothing funny here. SecDef Lloyd Austin was before the House Armed Services Committee, as was Joint Chief of Staff Chairman General Milley. There goes $773 billion on the table. That's the proposed budget. Actually, some House and Senate Republicans think the military needs more money than they're requesting. But Milley and Austin were there to defend the request, the funding request, as well as to field questions on, I don't know, the operation of the military under the woke leadership of one Austin and one Milley. And this is where Matt Gaetz picked up the issue, tied them together, and had a bit of a heated interchange with General Austin.
You guys told us that Russia couldn't lose. You told us that the Taliban couldn't immediately win. And so I guess I'm wondering, what in the $773 billion that you're requesting today is going to help you make assessments that are accurate in the face of so many blown calls?
You've seen what's in our budget. You've seen how the budget matches the strategy. And so I'll let that speak for itself.
Well, I mean, I've also seen that we're behind, Mr. Secretary. We're behind in hypersonics. We failed to deter Russia. Last year, China
flew more sorties. What do you mean we're behind in hypersonics?
Who's ahead in hypersonics?
How do you make that assessment?
I don't know. I make that assessment because China is fielding hypersonic weapon systems and we are still developing them. I make that assessment because Russia actually used one. By the way, your own people brief us that we are behind and that China is winning. Are you aware of the briefings we get on hypersonics?
I am certainly aware of briefings that we provide to Congress.
But it's not just the hypersonics. It's all over the world. It's in Taiwan, where China last year flew more sorties than ever before. It's North Korea, on pace to shatter prior records, the number of missiles that they are testing. And so while everyone else in the world seems to be developing capabilities and being more strategic, we got time to embrace critical race theory at West Point, to embrace socialism at the National Defense University, to do mandatory pronoun training.
Again, this is the most capable, the most combat credible force in the world. It has been, and it will be so going forward.
Not if we continue down this path. Not if we embrace socialism.
The fact that you're embarrassed by your country.
I'm embarrassed by your leadership. I'm sorry for that. I am not embarrassed for my country. Wow. I wish
it's
we were not losing
saying.
To China.
It's
I
what
wish
you're
we
saying.
Were, you know what? That is so disgraceful that you would sit here and conflate your failures with the failures of the uniformed service members. You guys said that Russia would overrun Ukraine in 36 days. You said that the Taliban would be kept at bay for months. You totally blew those calls. And maybe we would be better at them if the National Defense University actually worked a little more on strategy and a little less on wokeism.
Has it occurred to you that Russia has not overrun Ukraine because of what we've done and our allies have done?
But that was baked into your flawed assessment. That was baked into your flawed assessment. And so I saw that the Obama administration tried to destroy our military by starving it of resources. And it seems the Biden administration is trying to destroy our military by force feeding it wokeism. I yield back.
Mm. Wow. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's not too often you see a four-star general pantsed by a member of Congress, but that's what happened at that House Armed Services Committee hearing, as far as I'm concerned. And Gaetz is sometimes good and sometimes less good, but he was good there. And you know what? Bottom line is, regardless of what you think of Matt Gaetz, he's right on the merits. In February of this year, U.S. Senator Roger Wicker, who's a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican from Mississippi, and 11 other Republican members of the committee released data from the Department of Defense outlining time spent on key elements of the Biden Marxist social agenda. According to Milley, U.S. service members spent a total of 6 million, nearly 6 million man hours on diversity, equity, and inclusion training, including critical race theory. 6 million man hours since President Biden took office in January of 2021. And so when...
Well, it sounds like our priorities are out of whack.
Well, this is the, one of the points that, that Gates was making. Is this the highest, best use of time in this, particularly now, as thanks to Biden policies, the world is becoming a much more complicated and dangerous place than it was prior to his taking office? And again, this is not out of nowhere. We had this last summer when General Milley gave us his reading list, and he went back and forth. I've read Marx, I've read Mao, and so on and so forth. Like, that's the point. Point is not that you've read the full range of thinkers and ideologues throughout the course of, you know, the last couple of centuries, at least. That's not the point. The point is what you're doing in terms of the culture within the military. And as the Wall Street Journal opined at the time last year, you know, maybe for an organization that is dependent on esprit de corps among its rank and file, maybe the idea of steeping them in some people are oppressors and some people are victims based on their race, per the Ibram Kendi, Robin DiAngelo reading list, per these generals, maybe that's not the best idea.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And on the military readiness piece of it too, you know, we have the chest beating by Lloyd Austin, we have the most combat ready force in the world. That may well be true. And nobody is denigrating the military. And Gates was exactly right to call him out. I'm sorry you're ashamed of my country. We're having a discussion of what you're doing as Secretary of Defense, what this administration is doing to the military, because we all want America to be strong and free and to live in peace. And the question is, are the policies that you and this administration are pursuing advancing that? Or are we retreating from those goals because of the choices you're making? That's the issue. Jim Webb, former Democrat senator from Virginia, writing about the Marine Corps in the Journal just a couple of weeks ago, momentous changes in the Marine Corps force organization deserve debate. And he goes after the commandant there, General David Berger, and points out, which has not received a lot of publicity, you've got some 24 four-star generals that are questioning his Force Structure 2030 plan, which, of course, is a part of this conversation about the military budget. And Webb, who, of course, served with distinction in the military, elimination of this is the Marine Corps, elimination of three infantry battalions from the current 24, reduction of each remaining battalion by 200 Marines, taking an additional 4,200 infantry Marines from the frontline combat capabilities, elimination of two reserve component infantry battalions, elimination of 16 cannon artillery battalions, which is a 76% percent reduction, elimination of all the tanks in the Marine Corps, even from the reserves, elimination of the three current 17 medium tilt rotor squadrons, three of the eight heavy lift helicopter squadrons, and at least two of the seven light attack helicopter squadrons. And he goes on to say, you know, I can't make an assessment on this. I'm not an expert in this space, but Jim Webb is, and he's raising concerns. And he's basically saying, look, if General Berger's new ideas were well thought out and tested, we would be seeing 90% of retired generals enthusiastically supporting them instead of expressing concern. But the realities of brutal combat and the wide array of global challenges the Marine Corps faces daily argue strongly against a doctrinal experiment that might look good in a computerized war game at Quantico. 22 four-star generals deserve to be listened to for the good of the country. Let's hope they will be. And he was also, in addition to being a Marine infantry officer in Vietnam, Webb was also Navy secretary and then a U.S. senator. And the point is to say, maybe Berger, his plan makes sense in looking at China as the looming threat to make the Marine Corps more nimble, or maybe it doesn't. But these discussions need to be had, and the thinking needs to be more robust. And we have an administration and a senior leadership of the military that has us sidetracked on 6 million hours of die training like they're a bunch of administrators at some small liberal arts college, you know, in the Northeast. And those are both legitimate issues to raise. And the discussion in the context of who controls the purse strings at the House Armed Services Committee is the perfect time to raise them. Jim in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Did Gates say that the military is defending socialists?
Basically, yeah. Advancing socialism at the
military, a definition of socialism, it's the largest employer on the planet. The government employs every one of them. The largest single employer on the planet. Isn't that socialism?
Well, no. It's not socialism. I mean, what is socialism is the government control of the means of production, the private economy.
And so the government employing the largest single employer on the planet isn't an example of socialism?
So having, regardless of the size of the military, any military is an example of socialism? Any government is socialism? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we could certainly, there's certainly private-public partnership with the military, but these are military pensions. That's socialism, right? You've talked about pensions, public pensions.
So you're an anarchist, Jim? Is that your point?
No, I think the military is great, but I think we need clarity on the definition of socialism.
I just gave you clarity. Thanks for the call, Jim.
Well, they're spending 6 million hours doing, you know, socialist, like, indoctrinating people about pronouns and things like that.
Yeah, well, right. And they're talking about promoting the ideology of socialism within the ranks. And frankly, I wouldn't use the term socialism. I would more use the term, you know, identitarian-based Marxism. They've just replaced class with race, because that's what the identitarian movement is about, and it's taken hold in the military as per the defense offered by Milley and Naval Secretary last year at a similar House Armed Services Committee, and Austin as well. So that's the issue, and I assume that we understand the difference between a government-run police courts and military and government-run or directed private economy. I don't want to get bogged down in that any further, but I guess for the purposes of distinction and definition. Joe, Naperville.
You know, this Lloyd guy is pathetic. He's going to attack Gates because he can't answer his questions. Could you imagine if it was a white general answering like that to a black congressman? They'd be calling for his resignation tomorrow. And did we forget that the military looked into violent extremism and found nothing there? Their big study into violent extremism, and they found nothing. I think it's quite clear on why the left and the media wants to get rid of Gates with this false sex allegation.
Thanks, Joe. Text from 708, to be fair, 6 million hours is just over 4 hours per unit. I spent that much time standing by for transport. There's still an opportunity cost. It's 6 million hours misspent. And, by the way, it's the impact of those 6 million hours, too. Where are you building morale, or are you building suspicion as you're attempting to create identitarian ideologues among the rank and file? It's not just the hours. It's also the poison that's being peddled. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, you're right. It's a shame that an American general has to be pantsed by a congressman, but you know that both Gates is right, and you know that Lloyd Austin knows he's right when he has to go and he has to question his love of America.
Right.
That's a baseline. That's a baseline race. That's the same as calling someone a racist if you disagree with them simply because they're black.
Exactly. Thanks for the call, Tom. It's the last refuge of the scoundrel,
yep.
Or in Lloyd Austin's case, the first refuge.
He said, "The fact that you're embarrassed by your country, I'm sorry for that."
Dennis, Crystal Lake.
Oh, Dennis.
Are you, Dan, Amy?
Hey, I'll tell you what. I don't know if I ever told. I was in the Navy for 20 years. I was up in Great Lakes in 1979. And this, there was a strip up. The strip was really pretty nasty out there right outside the gate. And there was a lot of killings, a lot of beatdowns. And the upper chain of command's trying to calm us down like we're little babies. This is 12,000 engineers in these schools. And we said, heck with it. One day, the majority of people left the schools, went out on that strip, and just tore people up, tore their businesses up. We, as the enlisted man, don't take no garbage.
Okay, Dennis. I'm not sure I know what to do with that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've learned more about Elon Musk's accumulation of Twitter stock and see it on the board that we discussed a bit yesterday. He actually started acquiring Twitter stock on January 31st, and he has changed his filing with the SEC from passive investor to active investor. Now, he missed the deadline, so he may get a slap on the hands from the SEC about that. But regardless, the more important point is what his posture is. However, he agreed to take a board seat in exchange for agreeing not to push its stake in the company, which is now at 9.2%, to 15% or higher. So he's active, but he's also agreed to a cap in exchange for a board seat.
Okay.
What does this all mean for the future of Twitter in terms of will Twitter as it currently operates begin to operate differently, particularly with respect to its now infamous censoriousness, like all these other social media platforms controlled by cultural Marxists? That's the big question, right? What kind of influence will Musk have? How in any material way will Twitter change in terms of its operation? Do we have any indication of that? Well, let's ask somebody who follows this stuff very closely. He is Khalif Lataro. He's a senior media fellow at realclearpolitics.com. Khalif, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So your take on what we know about what Elon Musk wants to do and what he can do from the perch he now occupies.
You know, it's fascinating. The fact that Twitter issued that statement and said that while Musk has a board seat and is a major shareholder, he has no control of the company. It's strictly up to the executives to make all the choices. You know, that kind of ignores the fact that, well, he's in a position now where he could dismiss those executives or influence, the positioning of those executives. I think this is going to be a fascinating thing to watch. You saw, obviously, Bezos buy the Wash Post, and that was kind of the typical way that, rich people going back through time have kind of influenced the public discourse is to buy news outlets. Here you have something very different. You have a prolific Twitter user who's bought Twitter. And that to me is really interesting because social media is our gateway to the news media today. We don't pick up a physical paper or go to a newspaper's website. We consume it through social media. So he kind of has that trump card, essentially, where he's controlling this critical gateway. I mean, this is where politicians talk. This is where politicians hear from the constituents. He now is in this purse to control an awful lot about our public square.
Well, what kind of influence do you think he's going to have? I mean, do you think, he had wanted the edit feature for tweets, and now they're announced yesterday that they're soon going to be able to tweak your posts with an edit button? And what about bringing back people who've been banned from Twitter?
I think this is where the first wave of stuff that I see is he's going to do things like the edit button, things that he himself, as a prolific Twitter user, have always wanted, and that the company doesn't necessarily have a reason not to do it. You know, these are, I suspect that there's going to be a lot of things that Twitter's talked about. It's like, well, do we do it? Do we not? And now there's a reason to do it. I think where things are going to get really interesting is when he starts wading into the policy. So everything from what constitutes a tweet that could get you banned from the company on through restoring people like Donald Trump. And I think this is where, you know, and what's interesting is Musk is, you know, he's really making a lot of statements about freedom of speech and that social media has gone too far in censorship. So this is going to be just fascinating to watch that, you know, because the social media platforms have always gone in lockstep. What one does, they all do. I mean, even TikTok, a U.S. subsidiary of a Chinese company, tends to follow what the other companies do. And now you have this potential of a break where one of the major platforms now may go on its own direction. And if he does do all this, will that bring the other platforms with him? I mean, if Twitter reinstates Donald Trump, if it starts doing these things, will that force Facebook to reinstate him? Will that force other platforms to start taking a different tack towards this? It's going to be fascinating.
Well, the D.C. press corps is rallying around the current leadership of Twitter and probably trying to provide some aid and comfort and stiffen the spines of board members who perhaps might be inclined to join an Elon Musk coalition to make some policy or even personnel changes. I'll give you an example. NBC News, Elon Musk joining Twitter's board of directors should sound alarm bells. Why should it sound alarm bells? Well, according to NBC News, Elon Musk has previously committed the grievous sin of tweeting out what they consider misinformation. So it's very interesting to see the press corps trying to marginalize Elon Musk, even within Twitter, tell the Twitter folks, don't let this guy do too much over there. If he wants to tweet, if he wants to make the case for free speech, he can do so inside Twitter the same way he's been doing outside of Twitter. But it shouldn't change the way Twitter operates. And perhaps they're concerned, as you were just expressing, that if Elon Musk is able to build coalitions with inside the corporate governance of Twitter and make policy and personnel changes, that it will have a domino effect with other social media platforms to the extent that that improves Twitter's position, profitability, and the like.
Well, and what's interesting is Elon Musk is really the only one that stands a chance of changing how these platforms function. You know, most of these wealthy people, if they bought a platform, they'd have some hands on it, but they'd be a little bit more hands off because, you know, a lot of them, they run large companies. They're afraid, mostly they're afraid of negative press. They're afraid of regulatory entanglements. And, you know, you look at Musk, I mean, he's not afraid to go head to head with the SEC. He never shies away from these battles. And uniquely, he's been one to use Twitter itself as sort of one of his key weapons to sort of change the societal norms, to go after regulators, to change, laws that he doesn't like.
To create a digital currency. Yeah.
Exactly. And this is, to me, you know, he's someone who uses Twitter as his weapon. So this is his big weapon that he now kind of is establishing some level of control over. But most importantly, he's perfectly comfortable going to head to head. If there's something in his way, he's perfectly comfortable of leveraging his power, to change it. And so he's not that person that's going to buy Twitter and sit back quietly and meekly. If he wants to change something, he's going to do it. So, you know, he's essentially the one person that could change social platforms as they go. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see where he goes with it.
And I don't want to dampen the excitement from so many who are promoters of free speech. But, we've heard pronouncements in the direction of free speech from Zuckerberg over at Facebook, too. And then you get sort of half measures. But the reality of the operation is you still have these sort of 20 and 30 something engineers and content minders who are all of a particular political persuasion and still engaged in the same censorious practices. So you could have splashy headlines about free speech that Zuckerberg has generated, the same thing with Musk, but in terms of its actual day-to-day operation, not be materially different.
Well, that's what I think Musk is interesting, because like Zuckerberg, he's not out there putting controversial, you know, statements out there in the news all the time. He's one of those typical CEOs that tries to kind of duck and cover. Musk is one who's gotten caught up in those Twitter rules a lot. You know, he's someone that there's been a lot of calls for, you know, take him down, delete that tweet, banish him, and so on. And so, you know, I think what's interesting here is he's looking at it probably not from the standpoint of the rest of society, but, you know, for him himself, he wants to make certain that he's going to be able to say what he can, what he wants to. And I think that itself will change the norms, because to the degree that he's out there saying things that other people are, you know, removed from Twitter for saying, I think that's going to be a powerful, you know, kind of cudgel to change how we think. And I agree with you. I agree that, you know, this isn't where he's buying, you know, he has a stake and now magically social media has changed. I think what it's going to be is it's going to be these incremental steps and mostly just momentum. It's going to be, now that he has that power, he's going to do what he wants, as he always has, but there's going to be that extra bit now that Twitter's going to kind of give him that deference, and by doing so, we'll kind of reestablish these new norms for others.
Do you think he'll be safe now to say exactly what he wants all the time?
You know, I think there's going to be this period where probably there'll be some of that tension and some engineers might resign or, you know, there'll be, I think we're going to see some tensions coming out of that, you know, certainly, especially, you know, maybe some high profile engineers resigning, maybe some, you know, new policy statements. But, you know, at the end of the day, look at how Twitter's functioned to date. I mean, Donald Trump's removal, what's come out about it was, you know, this is a few people that made, you know, a few people that made a recommendation, one person that makes a decision. These companies are not democracies with councils and everything else. They're a handful of powerful people that make the choices about what we can see and say online. And so I think that, you know, just he's going to be a new voice in that, much closer to that central power set. And I think that's going to be really interesting. It's not, you know, this democracy. Social media isn't this democracy, and now you've got Elon Musk coming in. It's always been a few people making choices, and now Elon Musk's voice will be part of those decisions. So
yeah, see, that's where I think he might be going. I mean, this is just, you know, armchair quarterbacking here, but the whole concentration of the internet seems to me, from some of his tweets and public pronouncements, that he has concerns about that. He doesn't like it. He's in a position to use his power to diffuse power away from those few that control the big platforms and so much of the discourse. And maybe the sort of medium or long term result from this is the decentralization of, or the deconcentration of power online. Maybe that's what his real play is, well beyond Twitter.
You know, I don't know. I mean, that it'll be certainly interesting to see. And certainly you've seen those statements, but at the same time, those run contrary to, you know, the value of the company. I mean, Twitter's value is that it's a centralized platform. It makes the, you know, it controls this flow of information that the press and politicians are glued to. And it makes its decisions by itself, and sort of its decisions shape, you know, shape the broader discourse. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I've seen that rhetoric growing about the centralization of the web, but I haven't, you know, I don't necessarily see, I mean, obviously, blockchain and all these things are tossed around as these ideas for a new decentralized web. I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily see a major change, just because technically and especially economically, this is where the money is. If you're the gatekeeper, you're the one with all the ad dollars pouring in. So it's not in your best interest to decentralize. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see. And I think
that's
the first step.
Yeah. And that's why Musk is such an interesting character, because he's somebody that could spend a few billion dollars and not care about return on investment. He might have there may be a bigger play here. But, you know, you're right. We'll see. I don't know. It's just supposition on my part. Khalif Lataru, he's senior media fellow at RealClearPolitics.com. Khalif, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Obama coming back to the White House to celebrate Obamacare more than a decade in now, and try to prop up his old buddy Joe for his dutiful service as a functionary for President Obama during his two terms.
But they started out with a funny, Dan.
Yeah.
Everybody was so giddy. They were gushing all over. They were falling all over themselves to get to him. It was so nauseating. Did you see that? Like Kamala Harris was like,
yeah, she had a... He had to fight the press corps to get access to him. You know, everybody finds Barack Obama a beloved figure. I'm sure it's because of his wonderful work at Netflix since he left office. But here's Obama on his eponymous legislation.
To get the bill passed, we had to make compromises. We didn't get everything we wanted. That wasn't a reason not to do it. If you can get millions of people health coverage and better protection, it is, to quote a famous American, a pretty big deal.
But there's something that Obama said that's important to remember. Obviously, people like us recognized it at the time, and it's been borne out over time, like every other entitlement. But I like Obama's disclosure here, not just because it confirms what commonsensical people understood would occur at the time, but it confirms sort of the entire philosophy of the government-centric left.
The original Social Security Act left out entire categories of people, like domestic workers and farm workers. That had to be changed. In the beginning, Medicare didn't provide all the benefits that it does today. That had to be changed. Throughout history, what you see is that it's important to get something started, to plant a flag, to lay a foundation for further progress. The analogy I've used about the ACA before is that in the same way that was true for early forms of Social Security and Medicare, it was a starter home. It secured the principle of universal health care, provided help immediately to families, but it required us to continually build on it and make it better. And President Biden understands that. And that's what he's done since the day he took office.
That's exactly right. Not make it better, make it bigger. But bigger and better mean the same things to these leftists. Let's just get through the back door. Well, we can't get through the front door. Government takeover of health care. That's what Obamacare was. And then we'll grow it over time. And even when Republicans potentially gain power, they'll be loath to remove the entitlement that now so many believe is improving their lives because of, you know, the years of propaganda that has built up and hornswoggled so many people. And that's exactly what's transpired. I mean, we had that moment, and John McCain took that moment away where Obamacare could have been repealed in toto. But let's examine where Obamacare is now, more than a decade in. Like all these other government social engineering programs, it's overpromised and underdelivered at exponentially more cost than was originally projected. So Obamacare has done nothing to change life expectancy in America. I mean, there's, you know, a pretty good body of research here. It vastly overestimated the number of people that would enroll on the exchanges. From 2015 to 2020, exchange enrollment averaged about 10 to 11 million people. It's about 60% below what the CBO projected in May of 2013. Wow. In its last analysis before Obamacare provisions took effect. Low exchange enrollment may be explained by the individual market premiums increasing 105% from 2013 to 2017. The vast majority of enrollees receive large subsidies as the premium increases have largely priced unsubsidized individuals out of the market. Oh, boy, we've never seen this before. If you subsidize something, you get more of it. When you subsidize college tuition, you get higher college tuition. When you subsidize healthcare premiums, you get higher premiums. The laws of economics apply. They apply to higher education. They apply to the health insurance market as well. but we're being treated to Obamacare as a wild success with a few glitches to yet be ironed out. In other words, with more government interventions, including interventions to undo what was undone during the Trump administration, right? Lest we forget, there were several provisions of Obamacare that were rolled back, the individual mandate, the Cadillac tax on plans, the medical device tax under Trump. But of course, Obamacare, this backdoor takeover of health insurance, rolls on. So if and when Republicans do get control of Congress in 22 and the White House in 24, if that all comes to pass, should Republicans make the full repeal of Obamacare and a 180-degree reversal towards market reforms in health insurance, as was their promise after Obamacare was passed? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by C.S. Tucker. C. Stephen Tucker is the founder of healthinsurancementors.com, and he is a expert in the private health insurance market, has been for nearly three decades. He also was a recognized national expert on Obamacare when it was being debated and after it passed and since we felt the impacts. C.S., thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
So glitches. Yesterday we were told by the former president and the current president, you know, one of the glitches is the subsidies for family insurance plans aren't big enough. So if we can correct that glitch, Obamacare will be that much bigger and better.
The whole thing is a glitch. They're referring to the family glitch. And so what happened through the passage of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, known colloquially as Obamacare, the Office of, you know, they do the crunching of the numbers, the OMB and the CBO, et cetera, and they realized that if you provided subsidies for an entire family who also has access to employer-sponsored coverage, that it would not be feasible and it would not pass because it would cost even more than what they predicted, which, of course, we both know now is cost much more than they predicted. And so how it worked out and how it stands today is if a husband, for example, has a job and the employer is offering group health insurance and it costs him less than 9.6% of his total household income, then that is considered to be affordable. But there's a glitch, and the glitch is that the spouse and children are not eligible to obtain health insurance subsidies through the marketplace if the health insurance is affordable for the husband. So because he gets affordable health insurance, and even if the employer offers coverage to the spouse and children, it is at their entire cost. In other words, the employer doesn't subsidize their cost at all, the spouse and children. So you would think they'd be able to go to the health insurance exchanges, get a health insurance subsidy, and everything would be great. But that is not the case, and that is what the family glitch is. And so there's about 2 to 5 million people supposedly who can't get health insurance. Now, here's the truth regarding the glitch. First of all, I was running numbers ever since they said they were going to fix this glitch, which is something Hillary Clinton tried to do. They all tried to do it through Congress, of course. Now they're going to circumvent Congress and just do it by executive order because, you know, who needs Congress? So I ran some numbers as soon as they started talking about this yesterday. And here's the truth. The subsidies are based upon the entire family income. So let's go through a scenario of the average 40-year-old husband, 40-year-old spouse, and two children under the age of 19. At about $73,000 a year, let's say that's what they make, their children under the age of 19 will qualify for all kids covered, which is what we call in Illinois our state children's health insurance plan. So there'll be no cost to the kids to insure them. So the only person who would then seek coverage would be the spouse, the wife. So let's say she goes to the exchanges. Now understand, this is after they fix this supposed glitch, right? So they fix it. So she goes to the health insurance exchange. She enters in $73,331, for example, and she tries to apply for health insurance. The truth is, even after the quote-unquote glitch is fixed, she will not qualify for any health insurance subsidy. And why is that? Because
the law itself does not change. The law dictates how much of a subsidy you get based upon the entire household income. So if that family makes $73,331, she's not going to qualify for anything, even though they, quote unquote, fix the glitch. So it is more smoke and mirrors from the Biden administration. What is not talked about by anybody yesterday, and no one today, not even the fawning media, is that there's about 2.5 million people who are about to lose their subsidies entirely starting January 1 of 2023. And that is because the American Rescue Plan, which grossly enhanced subsidies to people making 800% above the federal poverty level, that funny money spigot shuts off on January 1 of 2023. So you may put a few million people through this, and they'll realize they're not eligible for the family glitch. The only people that will be eligible for the glitch are higher income earners or very, very low income earners, but not the middle class, which is what they touted. So let's say you help 2 million people, which I doubt very much that's going to happen, as I just demonstrated to you. But what about the 2.5 million people about to lose their subsidies entirely because the temporary band-aid they put on last year is about to be ripped off and ended on the same time that they plan to enact the supposed glitch fix? So the whole thing is smoke and mirrors.
But in that example that you give, then that's a perfect opportunity for the left to build upon what they've done, as you heard from President Obama yesterday, which is to say, well, exactly. So we need to keep the enhanced subsidies during COVID going. We need to expand subsidies to make sure that middle income families are covered and they can get subsidized plans like you're describing. And if you don't support that, then you're against health insurance for middle income families, and they put Republicans in that corner that they can never seem to get out of.
Right. Well, they tried, you know, in the Build Back Broker bill, which of course failed because, people are tired of printing money that we don't have, which of course leads to record inflation across the board from gasoline to everything else. And so it didn't pass. So the chances of them passing another bill, which they will have to pass a bill through Congress to enhance those subsidies. That's how they did it in 2021, and that's how they'd have to do it for 2022 and 2023. So I don't see any ability to do that in Congress. In fact, they just tried to pass another coronavirus bill, and it was shot down again. It was only about $10 billion. So where the supposed money is going to come from to extend this American Rescue Plan enhanced subsidies, I have no idea, because I don't see any more spending bills being passed by Congress.
Well, whether they pass it, whether they pass it or not, they'll blame Republicans and say Republicans stood in the way of us providing the money we want to provide you to subsidize your health insurance. And so it seems to me that Republicans need to get out of this, get off of this merry-go-round they're on with Obamacare and explain succinctly what has happened and what needs to happen if you actually want to see your health insurance premiums decline and the quality of your coverage improve. Because, you know, most of the enrollees under Obamacare have been through the Medicaid expansion, which is, for most people, the insurer of last resort. So that's not good news. But you as a policy expert here, tell me how you would advise Republicans who believe in, you know, a real health insurance market to message on this topic in this moment.
Well, the first thing I would do is bring attention to the fact, and this is a verifiable fact, that we have lost in America since 2013, 168 health insurance companies. They are gone. They were either gobbled up by the big handful of carriers left, right? Or they just simply went out of business because they could not afford to continue to operate under the ridiculous MLR calculations, medical loss ratio calculations. So when you lose that level of competition, there is no impetus for the big carriers to reduce prices. And so that is the problem we have now. And this fallacy that premiums have gone up by 115%, premiums in the marketplace have increased more than 300% since 2014. And the only reason people don't know about that is because they are masking it with these massive advanced premium tax credits paid for by you and I and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would tell Republicans to continually talk about is the fact that we did not need Obamacare to solve the issue of pre-existing conditions. HIPAA law did that way back in 1996. And the truth is, long before anyone ever heard of Barack Obama, 45 states in America, including Illinois, had a high-risk health insurance pool that guaranteed coverage for those with pre-existing conditions in the individual marketplace. It was run by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. That was the carrier of last resort. Again, long before anybody heard of Barack Obama. They can look it up. It's Public Law 104-191, Section 2742.
Oh, sure, of course. Yeah. I remember.
He has it memorized, too. Yeah, so do I. But remember the big lie of, you know, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor.
No.
And people who had, you know, that were seeing the same oncologist for their cancer treatment, that were torn away from them. And it was, I mean, it's very emotional and it's personal. And it was the biggest lie ever.
Yes. And it's still the case today, Amy. University of Chicago Hospital. Shame on them.
I know.
Rush University Medical Center. Shame on them. Lurie Children's Hospital, the premier children's hospital for all children in the Midwest. None of those hospitals will accept any individual policy, not even the last PPO left in Illinois from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. So, no, you cannot keep your doctor if you like your doctor, Mr. President.
Yeah, right, from the same people who subsequently brought you 2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really stark. And so last question. If, you know, my scenario I laid out on the front, if Republicans gain control of both the executive and the legislative over the next two cycles, would you advise them push for full repeal and, an expansion of HSAs and other market reforms so that people have dominion over their health insurance and their health care decisions and can actually keep a doctor that they like? And that is something that's doable, or are we too far gone now down this subsidy rat hole to ever claw this back, do you think?
It is my sad opinion at this juncture, after fighting against the implementation of this law for about 12 years, that it is too far down the line. It would be the same as trying to repeal Medicare at this juncture. Mm. And that's largely because of what I mentioned earlier. We have wiped out 168 health insurance companies in this country. And so how would you induce those carriers to come back and provide the kind of competition we would need to actually lower prices? It is almost impossible to do that at this juncture. And far too many people now are reliant upon these subsidies. So it would be virtually impossible to do. And we know the proof in this, because the last time Republicans had a chance to repeal Obamacare, it was not a repeal of Obamacare. It was simply a lowering of the subsidies. That's what it was.
He is C.S. Tucker, founder of healthinsurancementors.com. C. Stephen Tucker, thanks as always for your expertise. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Where have all the Fed doves gone? Yesterday, the ladies of the Fed tanked the market, led to a big tech sell-off. Fed Governor Lael Brainard saying that she wants the Fed to start to reduce its massive balance sheet soon and, key phrase, at a rapid pace. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly signaled support for more aggressive Fed action to reduce its balance sheet. And Fed Governor Esther George said a 50 basis point hike is an option for the early May meeting. What says Steve Moore about more aggressive action to try to rein in inflation by the Fed? Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, and author of GovZilla, joins us now. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys.
So what about this? Reduce the balance sheet faster, raise interest rates higher.
Yeah. I mean, I've only been saying that for 10 months. They're way, way behind the curve. In fact, we got some new wholesale prices data yesterday, and it shows that inflation is continuing to accelerate. So think about the odyssey that we've been through for the last 12 months. I mean, 12 months ago, the Fed said, there's no inflation. What is this? This is just scaremongering.
Transitory.
No inflation out there. Yeah. And then they moved from, we have a little bit of inflation, but it's transitory. It's temporary. And then there was a phase when the Fed and the media said, a little inflation isn't such a bad thing. And now they finally admitted that it's entrenched, but they've been so far behind the curve in terms of dealing with this inflation problem that it is metastasized like a tumor in the body. And so we've got this persistent inflation problem. And I think that it's more likely that the inflation rate goes up to 10% than it goes down from the 8% we're at right now. One other quick point. Yes, of course the Fed should be reducing its balance sheet. And by doing that, it actually sucks money out of the economy. And that very simply means less dollars in the economy. And that brings inflation down. But there's another part of this whole equation, which is all of these other kind of fiscal policies are the main driver right now of this inflation. The fact that we continue to borrow and spend and spend and spend. And then what's happening is as the government borrows and borrows and borrows more money, the Fed is buying up those bonds. And that means that you've essentially got this third world strategy of just, printing more money and then pretending that inflation won't happen. The idea of raising taxes and raising spending now is absurd. Can you imagine, by the way, how bad the inflation rate would be today if we had actually passed that Build Back Better, that $5 trillion abomination? I mean, we'd be looking at 15% inflation.
But I don't know how people on fixed incomes can survive. I mean, with the gas prices the way they are and everything at the grocery store is up.
Yeah.
You know how much a box of Goldfish is now, Stephen Moore?
I buy them all the time, but I didn't check the price the last time.
$8. Now it's over $8. $8. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Are they included in the CPI?
No, it's the snack. It's the Goldfish. It's a staple for every mom.
I know what the snack
you're making,
is. Yeah.
You're making me hungry there, Amy. But but I do know, like, I went to the grocery store the other day with my wife, and I just picked up a quart of milk, and I couldn't believe that it was like $5.69. It used to be like $2.89. And you're right, it's a total hardship. And look, the bottom line, folks, is this is a tax. I mean, I think the best way to explain inflation to people people understand it, but it's almost like a sales tax, right? So when you're paying more for those Goldfish, and that really hits you where it counts is when those Goldfish price go up.
Oh, yeah.
That's like a sales tax that you're paying. And so the annoying thing is Biden continues to say in every speech he gives, I don't tax anybody who makes less than $400,000. Yes, you do. Yes, you do, Joe. Every time we go to the gas pump, every time we go to the grocery store, every time I buy an airline ticket or rent a car, we're paying more. And by the way, look at the price of cars now and cars and the rental cars. You can't even get them. I mean, it has become quite a crisis, and it's very reminiscent of what we went through in the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter.
And so reminiscent meaning we're going to see high inflation for a time yet, and we're also going to see zero or negative growth. So we're going to see a recession in the next calendar year?
I still think we can avoid that, if we get serious about fighting inflation. So I don't want to say that it's baked in the cake, but the longer it persists, I like the metaphor of the tumor because, you've got to take it out quickly, before it metastasizes and gets bigger and bigger. And we haven't done that. We're way behind the curve on this. And it is, you mentioned people who on low incomes, and you're right, that there is affecting them. But who else gets really hammered by the high inflation is savers. So if you're somebody, let's say, worked your whole life, maybe built up a saving nest egg of maybe $500,000 over your lifetime, guess what happens? Every year under this inflation, your nest egg sinks. It gets smaller because you can't buy things. And, so it's not fair to people who are seniors. It's not fair to lower income people. It is the cruelest tax of all.
So you think Deutsche Bank economists were wrong because they wrote in a new report yesterday that the U.S. recession is going to begin late next year.
Could be. I mean, look, here's the thing. There was a report that came out. I have an item in our outline this morning. I hope everybody gets the outline and go to Committee on Unleash Prosperity, and we'll send it to you for free. But there's an item this morning that we just sent out, and I had forgotten about this, but one of my colleagues sent this to me 9 months ago. No, not month. It was September, so that would have been, what, about 6 months ago, Dan. There were 17 Nobel Prize-winning economists who signed a statement saying half the Build Back Better bill, the inflation is not going to be a problem. No problem with inflation. These were supposedly the best economists we've got. And they said something so monumentally stupid and wrong. And 6 months later, of course, inflation has gotten much, much, much worse. And these economists should lie prostrate and beg for forgiveness for their idiocy. So I don't believe one word a lot of these economists say.
No, well, you know the old joke about economists. If you laid every economist in the world end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion.
Ed Crane has a version of that. You know, if you lay every economist on earth from end to end, it would be a good thing.
Exactly. It's like lawyers at the bottom of the ocean. It's a good start. I got it. So
can you believe that, though? Think about that. 17 of the best economists in the
the
world.
They're political. They're political operatives.
Don't worry about inflation. Well, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
That there's no more science. This is one of my new pet peeves. There is no such thing as, quote, science anymore. And I've got air quotes when I say science. Unfortunately, in this era that we live in, all science has become political, all of it. And it's so heartbreaking because you don't know who to believe anymore.
I know the markets is not necessarily your focus. But, I mean, if you're talking about a rapid increase in interest rates or a more rapid increase in interest rates, as well as the Fed reducing its balance sheet, then you're talking probably about a fairly significant market correction before the year's out. So when people are thinking about their portfolio, they should be thinking about hard assets, real estate, gold, those sorts of things.
Cryptos. Yeah. I mean, I am not a great financial analyst, but I would say this, that, we've had quite a run up in stocks over the last, 10 years. And,
buoyed by quantitative easing, buoyed by the Fed,
exactly,
and its balance sheet.
Pumped up. Yeah. It's, what's really annoying to me? Do you guys remember 2007 and 2008? We all do. That crash in the real estate market. And, doing today all of the things we did in 2005, 6, and 7 that led up to that crash. It's like we learned none of the lessons. Look at the housing market today, Dan and Amy. You can't, in a lot of places, there's no way young people can buy a house today. Those housing prices are astronomical.
Well, you got to pay cash, and you got to get on it right away. Yeah. I mean, we had an apartment for rent on our seat, and there were six people in line to rent it. Couldn't believe it.
So I do worry, Dan, I'm more worried about a potential real estate crash like we saw in 2008. Because all the Fed has been doing the last 3 or 4 years, pumping money into the economy, and a lot of it has gone right into the housing market, just like we did in 2006 and 2007. So I pray I'm wrong about that, folks. Mortgage rates are up to 4.5%. They were 3% just about a year ago.
But you don't have the same lax lending standards you did pre-07-08. So
yeah, could get mortgages.
I think that's a big difference. Here's the thing, though, I wanted to get your intuition on.
Yeah, except that the Fed has been pumping up the housing market by buying a lot of these mortgage securities. So I don't know if I agree with you, the lax lending standards. I don't know. I mean, I'm worried about it.
Well, here's the thing, though, too, thinking about this. We talk about these phenomena in macro terms, but we're increasingly a micro country. The worlds between red states and blue states are growing further and further apart with each passing day. And I wonder, in a stagflation environment, that the experience or the hardship will be very different in a place like Florida as compared to a place like Illinois. Do you see different states weathering any economic downturn very differently?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that the red states, just have so many people coming in. I mean, I just got back again from Florida, and
you know, you just, it's just so packed with people now and a vibrant place. Incidentally, we have a new report that's coming out just in the next couple of days that we did at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity with Casey Mulligan. He's at University of Chicago, and myself and a couple of others. This is probably the most comprehensive study ever done on which states handled COVID the best and which handled COVID the worst. Mm. And we looked at three variables, Dan, maybe. We looked at what happened to the death rate in the states. In other words, did the states keep their citizens safe? Number two was, how did they deal with the economy? Did they keep their businesses operating? Were they able to keep people out of unemployment lines and so on? And the third factor was, did schools keep did states keep their schools open? Because we now know that shutting down schools was a catastrophic mistake that hurt our nation's children very dramatically. Anyway, guess what state was fourth to last?
Let's see. It had to be South Dakota or Florida, because I know Illinois, New York, and California will be at the top of the list.
Yeah, so New Jersey was the worst in the country. New Jersey, a blue state.
Really?
The second worst state in the country was New York. The third worst state in the country was California. And the fourth worst,
Illinois.
Yay!
And we're still.
Re-elect Pritzker. He did such a great job of dealing with COVID, the fourth worst. And incidentally, I think you mentioned South Dakota. You know, I think it was basically Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, Florida, Utah, they all, you know, came through this with flying colors. They mm-hmm. didn't shut down their economy. They actually had lower death rates. Florida has a lower death rate than Illinois does when you age adjust the data, because obviously old people are the people who died from COVID. And yet Florida kept its economy open. Illinois shut down everything and they have a higher death rate.
And we're still isolating healthy kids. 719 today, Stephen Moore, that are sitting at home. 719 healthy kids from Chicago Public Schools are still sitting at home today. Every day changes, because if you're around somebody who had COVID, you still can't go to school. So when people say the lockdowns are over, the lockdowns are not over. Just remember that.
That is so heartbreaking, by the way. Here we are 2 years later, and the left still doesn't understand anything about COVID and what are the appropriate measures. I mean, it's one thing to shut down the economy and shut down schools 2 years ago, but to still be doing that is almost criminally negligent.
We'll look forward to seeing the details of that report, but we appreciate the top lines there. Steve Moore, economist, author of Trumponomics, and more recently, GovZilla. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Yeah, by the way, Dan, thanks so much for the invitation to your 50th birthday party. I really appreciate the invitation.
You should have been a roaster. Why?
All my friends were telling me how great it was.
I figure you're too important to come to my birthday roast. You know, you're hanging out with Kudlow and Laffer. You don't have time for little guys like me.
I would have brought the whole gang. Anyway, congratulations. I heard it was a great time, and I heard Amy really was. Really,
she's mean.
Really,
she's mean.
Yeah. I'm so mean. Brilliant is the term.
There you go. All right, guys, have a great week.
Thanks. He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was at a press avail announcing some infrastructure projects yesterday. And he took the occasion to address the ongoing controversy surrounding legislation he signed that provides parental rights in K through 12, particularly K through 3, as it relates to protecting kids from gender ideology indoctrination in those primary grades. Here's DeSantis again explaining the principles behind the legislation that's being so mischaracterized by the D.C. press corps and other cultural elites.
And another thing that we're really proud of in Florida is making sure that we're empowering parents and standing up for the rights of parents. Very important. You know, the idea, like I have a 5-year-old daughter, you know, the idea that she should be in school having things like sexuality in the curriculum, is inappropriate. It is wrong. And we're not going to allow that to happen in the state of Florida. And we were right to sign the bill to protect the parents' rights. And it's not just about the curriculum. You know, we had the bill we signed gives parents the right to be notified and to have control over different types of services that are provided, like health services, to students in these schools. We had a mother from Leon County, and her daughter was going to school, and some people in the school had decided that the daughter was really a boy and not a girl. So they changed the girl's name to a boy's name, had her dress like a boy, and doing all this stuff without telling the mother or getting consent from the mother. First of all, they shouldn't be doing that at all. But to do these things behind the parent's back and to say that the parent should be shut out, that is wrong. And so we're going to make sure that in Florida, parents have the fundamental role in the education and well-being and socialization of their kids. Schools are very important, but they do not supersede the rights of parents. And so I can tell you,
schools are very important, but they do not supersede the rights of parents. Such an important statement of principle there. And of course, he's right about what some of these radical indoctrination centers called schools have become. We've played any number of examples on this show. Abigail Schreier, when she obtained audio from a California Teachers Union convention where they talked about how to work around parents when it comes to this sort of instruction or this sort of conduct. And the other piece of this, since Disney has made itself the lead in fighting DeSantis and Florida Republicans on this. What about Disney's culture? You know, I was thinking about this, Amy. We had a former Hollywood screenwriter named Tiffany FitzHenry on the show a couple years back, and she brought to our attention and to the world's attention, certainly amplified it, sort of the culture inside Disney for these kids that grew up as Disney stars and then went on to careers in entertainment or did not. And the incidence of the exploitation, specifically the sexual predation that has occurred against kids within the Disney universe. Many examples. Here's one. Bella Thorne grew up as a Disney star. She's now in her early to mid-20s, and she's a singer and an actress. This is part of an interview she gave about her experience at Disney in those formative years when she was a preteen into her teenage years.
But it is what it is. Like, it's like anything in my life. I mean, if you read the book, you'll be like, transitioning from Disney to this was f-ing easy. I don't know. Getting molested from your 6 to your 14 seems like way harder circumstances, or being physically abused all the time seems like a much more difficult situation than f-ing have paparazzi following you since you were 12. I don't know. I was still being molested when paparazzi were still f***ing following me. So it's pretty hard in my mind to think about these big flashlight photographs and everyone thinking they know me and talking about me, but having no idea the type of mistreatment that I was still dealing with at that time, that everyone around me saw and did nothing. So I don't know. You tell me what's so hard. Because that to me, way harder than any other of this other shit that I do on a daily basis.
Somebody just said goosebumps.
And we Tiffany FitzHenry focused on the case of Ricky Garcia, whose mom is suing Disney as well as some talent agencies for the molestation, the alleged molestation of her son during those same formative years when he was put together with other young boys to form a boy band that was featured on the Disney Channel. Chris Rufo over at City Journal, who's been outspoken on critical race theory, has also picked this up. Disney has had employees arrested for child sex crimes in 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022. In other words, at least once a year for the past decade. And he is tweeting out the mugshots alleged crimes, and in some cases, not alleged anymore because these former Disney employees were convicted.
And these are people that worked on the Disney ships that had access to a lot of children while their parents were away. You know, they put them in care rooms and they didn't take care of them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. And so the question becomes, and perhaps should be turned around on Disney the way that Rufo and others are doing, and that we started doing 2 years ago when some of these stories came to our attention. Now, what exactly is the corporate culture at Disney? You're taking a position opposite parents of kindergartner through third grade. And what's happening with respect to young kids in your charge who you're using to, you know, make money, turn into stars? What is happening there? But keeping children safe and being the great guardian of young people that Disney is presenting itself to be. Yeah, maybe a little bit of a proctology exam on Disney corporate is required now that they've put themselves in the arena to hash this all out, particularly as we're hearing from Walt Disney's, I think, great-granddaughter, heiress to the Disney empire, you know, castigating people who suggest that parental rights supersede the school when it comes to things like gender ideology indoctrination. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Matt Purple, who is the online editor of the Spectator's World Edition. Matt, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be back. Thank you.
What about turning the tables on Disney here? DeSantis is defending his legislation and the basis for it, and that's all well and good. But to the extent that Disney has decided to take the lead here, let's peel back the layers of Disney and find out exactly what's going on inside Disney World, so to speak.
Yeah, it's I think your monologue there was very apropos, and it's a bit awkward for me because I grew up in the 1990s watching these shows in Nickelodeon, and it's kind of a golden age for children's television. And you know, we later find out the cost of that, right? The price of that, and that is Lindsay Lohan is all messed up. Billy Ray Cyrus, Miley Cyrus's father, she was on the Disney show Hannah Montana.
I love that show.
He says that the show, I did too, and my sister really did, and he said that show destroyed their family because of the callous way that they were treated. You have Amanda Bynes, who's all messed up. You have Dan Schneider, the executive producer over at Nickelodeon, who produced like half a dozen of their best shows. And he's been unsuspiciously let go, unceremoniously let go. There have been rumors about what a terrible, well, we'll just say how terrible he is for years. This is a major problem, not just at Disney, but I think across the industry. And what bugs me most about the sudden woke turn they're taking, you know, claiming to stand with LGBTQ and so on, is it's cheap virtue, right? They're trying to get virtue on the cheap. You can get into other matters, too. They've been underpaying their workers severely in Orlando for years. It's like a fiefdom down there, almost. They're pricing the middle class out of their theme parks. I mean, these are very cynical corporations, and they don't actually want to reform. They don't, not that much anyway. They don't want to dig into their profit margins. What they do want to do is make it look like they're doing good, make it look like they have a social conscience. And that's where a lot of this woke stuff comes from.
And they also present themselves as, you know, the promoters of tolerance and accepting people for who they are and so on and so forth. You know, they're not indoctrinators. They don't have any particular agenda here. They're just let everybody be who they are. When in point of fact, we see, for example, the Seattle's Pop Culture Museum, founded by Paul Allen, the late Paul Allen, Dragtastic Summer Camp for ages 12 to 18. Where you spend a summer having individuals teach you the art of being a drag queen, for example. And I mean, you know, and obviously something that's become much higher profile, the drag queen story hour at libraries and so on and so forth. And all of this stuff is not supposed to be tolerated. It's mandatory that you celebrate. And that's different.
Yes, it is. It is mandatory. And it's also just wrong in the first place. And this is the amazing thing. Whenever you're talking about identity politics in this sense, right, in the way that the left talks about it, you're talking about a kind of finite amount of power. You're taking power away from somebody and give it to somebody else. And in this case, it's the LGBTQ. It's the you know, the trans, it's the human rights campaign, it's these activists who are getting the power. And, you know, I'm not saying there isn't a case for gay rights. I'm just saying they're the heirs to this. The ones who are losing the power are children and parents, right? They're having that taken away from them. And especially in the case of public schools, which you brought up before, if the teachers get the power, if the education bureaucrats get the power, the parents lose it. And that's increasingly what we're seeing. This legislation down in Florida should not be remotely controversial. It's just telling, it's not banning, you know, gay people. It's not stigmatizing LGBTQ, however many letters they've tacked on since then. It's just saying that parents discuss these issues with their kids, period. That this is not something, certainly not at such a young age, that that teachers and educators are supposed to be dealing with. And the fact that it's caused such a firestorm, some of that is cynical politics, but I think some of that just shows how far we've come.
And parents that are upset can fight back against Disney. I mean, cancel Disney Plus, cancel Disney movie clubs, or even, you know, don't, you know, cancel that vacation you had planned. And people
and don't
are
let
doing that,
that mouse hug you.
Well, and I know, and time means everything. Now, Mickey Mouse, they announced yesterday, can hug people again in the park because COVID's, you know, the numbers are down.
You know, also, have you been to Disney World? I used to go all the time when I was a kid. My mother is from, you know, Massachusetts, so she can't relax unless she's in Florida. But we were always down at Disney World.
I'm stealing that line.
And yeah, your Midwestern audience will appreciate that joke. But yeah, we went to Disney World quite a bit. And if you go now, it's kind of old and dated and faded. It's falling apart. Epcot Center, which used to be one of their best parks, it's supposed to show you the future, like future world and what that would look like. But it kind of looks like what the 60s thought the 80s would look like. Like, it's just very, it's very dated. So they're not updating the parks. They're charging an outrageous fortune for you to come there. I mean, they've just been hiking and hiking the fares, trying to make more money. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's, you know, you got Universal Studios down there. You got the Harry Potter world. I think that's a part of Universal. Maybe it's time to consider some other options.
I wanted to get your reaction to something else on topic and someone else that's on topic, generally speaking. Republican governor of Utah, Amy's future home, perhaps future governor, Spencer Cox,
yeah,
who recently vetoed legislation that would prohibit men from playing women's sports. And then he hosted this online kids seminar of sort. And listen to what your Republican governor of frickin' Utah had to say.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I am Governor Spencer Cox, and I have the pleasure today of hosting the first One Utah student town hall. And my preferred pronouns are he, him, and his. I believe in helping young leaders learn and grow by listening to them and providing platforms to share their voices. Leading with equity and inclusion starts at a young age, and the students that are joining us today have shown great leadership through their academic achievements and civil and civic participation in our state.
Who makes me Miss Governor Herbert?
I think Mrs. Spencer Cox is in for a surprise at some point during their marriage, but I digress.
Yeah.
His pronouns are he and him, in case you were wondering, Matt.
Yeah, I had an aneurysm after the pronouns part, so I didn't hear anything else. I'm curious as to what's up in Utah. You know, they elected Mitt Romney, and now this guy is the apparent Republican governor. I thought they were a fairly conservative state, but I also don't know it very well, so I don't want to, you know, judge it too much. I don't know what's going on in the water out there, but yeah, I mean, it just it's becoming the dividing line, really, isn't it? I mean, the people who think that it's, you give in just a little bit and start stating your pronouns, and maybe you can hold off some of the other woke tidal wave, the worst stuff that's coming down the line.
Well,
I mean, that's just bizarre.
Well, yeah.
The good news is the Utah legislator voted to override his decision. So, just in case you want to know,
yeah, but that's, yeah, it's an important example because, you know, people have short memories. We're going to comply with the left's pronoun usage protocol, as you say, to just give in a little bit, you know, let's be sporting. But then we're going to stop it there. You know, Matt, how we were going to give in on civil unions and then we'd stop it there. Then we wouldn't have a redefinition of marriage. And that's how that turned out.
Yeah, the slope is very slippery. I know it's supposed to be a fallacy, but the slope is getting very, very slippery. And yeah, I mean, I think at some point you just have to draw a line in the sand and you have to say, no, it should be very obvious from talking to somebody what gender they are. And that's not to dismiss, you know, the very small percentage of people who have gender dysphoria and they need help and they need counseling and they need, you know, we need to be helpful to them as a society. Certainly, I'm not saying rule them out, but the vast, vast, vast majority of children who experience this get over it. Right. Everybody goes through something bizarre during adolescence. It's a very confusing, very turbulent time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to look at a child and to say, as DeSantis was talking about before, and to say, oh, you feel this way right now? You can become a woman. You can dress up however you want to. We'll give you puberty blockers. You can change yourself forever. That I think is abuse of the worst order.
Well, and then add on to that. And we don't have to tell your parents.
Yeah. Yep, the parents have no say in it. Again, you have that transfer of power away from the kids, and it's just it's this ongoing abolition of gender, right? This is really, I think, the big issue of our time. Is as soon as that Obergefell decision came down from the Supreme Court, which legalized gay marriage, there wasn't even a moment for a party, right? There wasn't even like a celebration. It was just okay, on to the trans stuff, and it's remarkable. We're blazing forward so fast, we don't have time to stop and think about this. We don't have time to even apply common sense. And that's why I think this parents' rebellion is so important, because this is really, this is the pushback, right? This is the counter-revolution, and it's the best chance I think we have at stopping this.
He is Matt Purple. He's the online editor of the Spectator's World Edition. Matt, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Centers for Control are doing a little institutional review. Dr. Rochelle Walensky announced on Monday, hiring a senior public health official from Atlanta to come in and do a little performance review of CDC.
Are they going to release the data to the, you know, investigate their own agency?
They're going
to
look at
they want to.
You know, systems, policies, procedures, make sure you know, everything is copacetic. Mm. Yeah, I'm going to put a fresh coat of paint on the agency, if you will. She said in a statement, Dr. Walensky, never in its 75-year history has CDC had to make decisions so quickly based on often limited real-time and evolving science. As we've challenged our state and local partners, we know now is the time for the CDC to integrate the lessons learned into a strategy for the future. Mm-hmm. They just want to stay up to date.
Oh, sure.
I can't wait to hear the lessons learned. The whole thing strikes me as Christopher Wray testifying before Congress about his, you know, 15-point plan to address FBI agency failures during the Russian collusion hoax the FBI so dutifully participated in under Jim Comey. For more on how optimistic we should be, if I can contain my laughter, about this performance review, pleased to be joined again by Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute and author of the book Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You know, I just adore when I get an email from you saying that I should come on your show. I love being here.
Well, we love having you. We usually have a lot of laughs, usually because we're talking about public health officials and COVID, and you have to laugh to keep from crying. So your level of sanguinity over this CDC performance review.
Well, I don't know. This agency, last I checked, they had a budget of gazillion billion dollars. I can't remember precisely. But if they don't, you know, they have plenty of resources to investigate themselves. You know what it's like. If you ever worked for a company where the CEO comes in and says, well, we got a lot of problems. We've got an outside consultant going to come in and do a thorough review. You know, that's the time to start looking for another job.
Right. We want you all to cooperate. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we know how that goes. This is just purely cosmetic. And the answer to the CDC is, I don't know, truth and transparency. How about that? You know, why don't we start there?
Crazy talk.
They're sitting on so much data right now. They've released a tiny fraction of what they know. And every time they do release it, we get a different picture, you know, like taking off
childhood youth deaths, you know, like they did last month, and they're sitting on all kinds of data related to the side effects of the vaccines, adverse effects of the vaccines, which is, you know, approaching a crisis level. I mean, you've got people out there right now who say, oh, these things are perfectly safe and effective, everybody should get them, although, you know, every 7-year-old needs to get a double vaccine booster. And other people who say, look, this is killing. This is the killing fields out there, what these things are doing with the myocarditis and the bringing in the ears thing and just all sorts of things. And we have a hard time even answering these questions. How safe is the vaccine? And that is because the CDC is not doing its job. It has the data. It has the capacity to look into this. Why aren't they concerned about the safety of these vaccines? Why aren't they investigating it? I don't know what's going on over there, but I can tell you, serious scientists in this area are furious and confused and actually extremely demoralized because this is their profession. The CDC collects the data and distributes it to scientists so they can write papers and give information to the public. They're being denied access to vast amounts of data, and they're all pulling their hair out. Meanwhile, you know, we've had going on, 6, 8, 10 months of these vaccine mandates, a lot of people being forced to get these vaccines about which we know not that much. And we know about the effectiveness because of independent researchers having discovered that the effects of the vaccine wane surprisingly quickly, so that after a few months, there seems to be no difference between the vaccinated and unvaccinated in terms of the propensity towards infection spread or even severe outcomes. So we know that. But what are the side effects of these things? And why doesn't the CDC care? And why aren't we being told?
With respect to the data, I assume the CDC is following the FDA's lead in terms of time horizon. And as with the Pfizer trials on the vaccine, we should get that CDC data parceled out in bites that we can digest over the next 60 to 80 years. And so by the turn of the century, we should have a handle on it.
Yeah, and you know, my friends tell me, and I'm not an expert, this is a very technical area, this area of vaccine safety and effectiveness, and this is not for lay people, but what the situation has forced is for everybody to kind of get involved in looking at these Pfizer documents, and people are very alarmed, you know, by what they're showing. And it's getting scary. It's one thing, and I wrote this in a long kind of what I thought was an honest reflection on Brownstone. It's one thing for you on your own initiative to take your own risks with a medicine. You know, here's a medicine that helps with stomach cramps, and you know it has side effects, but the cramps are so bad you're willing to take the risk. And if it doesn't turn out well for you, well, it's a little bit on you, you know? But when it's mandated, it's a different thing entirely. And these people were forced into getting these vaccinations, whether they thought they needed them or not, at pain of losing their jobs. And many people, hundreds of thousands of people, really, elected to lose their jobs rather than take the risk of these vaccines. I mean, there's no way public health should have ever put people in this position. I find it astounding
that this ever
happened.
I mean, and you think we've, you know, 2,000-plus Chicago police officers, firefighters, who are in the process of being let go because they're not vaccinated. And now you have, you know, a third booster that they're recommending for this fall. So it's not going to just stop with the two vaccines because now we have a booster. Now we have a third booster. So that's five shots. I can't keep up.
Yeah, right. And mandated for a lot of public sector employees. So it's gutting the public sector. And there's a real issue of justice here also, because a lot of the people that have been most affected by these mandates are the people who are on the front lines during lockdowns, mm-hmm. exposing themselves to the virus, during which time Zoom class professionals were all hunkered down in their living rooms looking at their laptops and being on phone calls in Zoom and Slack, staying safe. So these people got natural immunity. Then one day, and I think it was just a catastrophic error by the Biden administration. Just catastrophic. There was a push to mandate these things universally. I think we're going to look back at that as really the worst public health
era next to lockdown, you know, of the century.
And
it's still going on, by the way. You know, I mean, like, you know, everybody in the country is trying to forget about this, but yeah, I got an email yesterday from a friend of mine who works for, I don't know, some architectural commission for the New York City municipal government or something like that. Absolutely, you know, healthy young man, you know, high risk of myocarditis, looked at the data, said, I don't want the vax, and guess what? He's losing his job, and he's writing me going, do you have any idea where I should be looking for a job? This is tragic, because he's refusing to accept the government-mandated medicine about which we don't know that much. You know, it's a real... I mean, I really cannot believe that this is still happening. Also, the public is so exhausted from outrage that it's hard for people to get outraged all over again, but people should be.
And one of the things that one of the things that continues to happen, the lesson that refuses to be learned, it seems, is any acceptance of healthy skepticism from experts in the field. And so the FDA authorized the fourth COVID vaccine dose for 50 and over. But some of the FDA's own experts disagreed with the decision, and they were just ignored. Eric Rubin, who's the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, said he hadn't seen enough data to determine whether anyone needs a fourth dose whose immune system isn't seriously deficient. Another committee member, Cody Meisner, who's infectious disease expert, pediatric infectious disease expert at Tufts Children's Hospital, said the fourth dose is an unanswered scientific question for people with a normal immune system, and yet the FDA just rolls over them.
So we need to understand something about the FDA's financing. Fully half of its budget is funded by pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. Now, you could look at that and say, so what? Or you could observe that this is a kind of an institutionalized conflict of interest. So it's not entirely...
It's the same old story of agency capture.
Yeah, and in this case, it's extreme, right? I mean, I remember looking at the Pfizer application. Somebody sent me an email. It was like, oh, look at this. And it was an email from Pfizer to the head of the FDA's vaccine approval, whatever, a woman who since resigned and protest against the booster for young people because she thought it was catastrophic. So she left the FDA herself. But at the bottom, it's a PS encloses a check for, and I'm going to slightly make up the number. I can't remember. Let's just say it was $1.4 million. Encloses a check for he said, I've sent a wire to the U.S. Treasury for $1.4 million. And I thought, oh, here's the scandal. This is a scandal. This is a smoking gun. Well, it turns out this is just the application fee for the EUA. And this is considered normal business for the FDA. This is an outrage. I mean, it's unbelievable that we tolerate this. And the information I just told you is known by, well, how many Americans even know this, you know? The FDA is basically entirely in the pocket of Big Pharm. I mean, you know, what does that imply about the drugs you're being prescribed? Or actually much more scary, what does it imply about the things that you're required to take on penalty of losing your job? So, wow, do we have some reforms to make and some investigations to do? Yeah, I would say so.
He is Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of the book Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.